You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
We're talking this month about TRAPPIST-1, the system of planets discovered late last month. And we'll be talking to one of the researchers on that team as well. But first off, let's stick in our solar system. And we've had images from a while back from the Rosetta mission. Hard to forget Rosetta, this space probe that went to Comet 67P and took images over several years. And it found it's found a landslide.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. Also, they found that the landslide was coordinated or at a similar time to an outburst. So one of the things that we can see from comets from far away, say the ground, is when they appear to brighten. And this phenomenon isn't actually known very much about why they suddenly get brighter. And as we got closer to comets with missions like Giotto and the Rosetta mission, we found out that there were some of them were explosive jets, and other of them were just because the comet itself was rotating. But this outburst seems to be timed to fit in with this landslide that we can actually see a part of the floor of the comet falling away. Now, it's quite interesting because you tend to think of the a landslide on Earth as being something falling towards the centre of the Earth. But on Comet 67P, gravity is actually a little bit of a fickle beast. Because
it's this weird duck shape.
Yeah, that's right. It's a duck shape. And so gravity has a different pull wherever you stand on the surface of the comet. And so that can affect the shape of the outburst that you had.
And we should say that the Rosetta mission didn't capture a video of a landslide happening, but what it did do is when looking around this the time of this big outburst, they found a little bit of a cliff. I mean, the comet is amazing with all these. We can talk about landscapes, cliffs, and landslides. The fact we can do that about a little comet is amazing.
I know, it's amazing.
But they found a cliff which had a crack in it that was about maybe 12 metres back from the edge and about 50 metres long or something. And they took an image of that. There was an image of that, and then after the outburst, there's then an image of that chunk of the cliff missing, and a whole lot of extra boulders at the bottom of the cliff. So yeah, it's kind of a smoking gun for there having been a landslide, of course.
Yeah, and also they tied it in with this this plume of material, and they also can see some pristine interior of the comet that's been exposed because of this landslide.
So lots of stuff still going on with data from Rosetta, of course, and I'm sure there'll be lots more to come out over coming years. Sticking with space missions, this one's not a space mission. This is a mission on a planet. This is the Curiosity mission. This six-wheeled, small car-sized rover trundling around Mars. It's driven about 10 miles since August 2012 when it landed. So it's about halfway through its planned traverse distance, how it plans to drive. And it's got some problems appearing with its wheels.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't sound very much to have gone 10 miles in the last 5 years, but it is stopping and doing stuff. And, you know, it's also on Mars.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it has six wheels that are made out of machined aluminium. And one of them's got a crack in it. And also, I'm not sure if it's the same wheel or a different wheel, has a stone lodged in it.
Yeah.
But it's a hardy thing, so it's not going to disrupt it. It's actually one of the things that they expect and why they made it out of aluminium, so that it would withstand this type of thing, why the wheels aren't made of rubber, for example.
Yeah, I mean, they noticed a few years ago that it was getting holes punched in its wheels from sharp rocks it was driving over, so then decided to actually carefully plan the route to avoid sharp rocks.
Yeah.
And the problem they've got now is with the treads that go across the wheel. These little ridges of aluminium, those are what's starting to break. And I think they're testing here on Earth in sort of Mars-like simulations. We can't simulate the gravity of Mars because we'd need to go to Mars, that's hard.
Yeah.
But what they can do is they can simulate it with a rover that's a little bit lighter to give the same effect. And they've said that it seems to be that once three of these treads on a wheel break, which is what happens to the middle left wheel, I think. Yes, the middle left wheel. Then it's 60% through its useful lifetime, so just over halfway through. So it matches with the total mission plan.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Yeah, something to watch out for. I'm sure they're watching that very carefully.
Yeah, we don't want our rover going round in circles.
Sticking in the solar system, we have the planet Saturn. Now, you'd think we've got the Cassini mission orbiting Saturn, sending back amazing pictures all the time. Saturn's rings were discovered about 400 years ago by Galileo. You'd think we kind of understood Saturn, but we're still finding stuff out.
Yeah, so Saturn's rings appear to have gaps in them. And these are one of these gaps is called the Cassini division. And for a long time, people thought that it was just stuff missing. But actually, there is stuff in the gap. It's a lower density than some of the other ones. It also has a different... It's made of different stuff. It doesn't reflect in quite the same way as the rest of Saturn's rings. And an infrared telescope on the Earth, Subaru, which is run by the National Observatory of Japan, looked at Saturn at different times over a period of, I think, 4 years. And Saturn changes its orientation so that the rings are sort of edge on and then they tip a little bit. Saturn never goes sort of 90 degrees to us. But you do see the rings tip a little bit, so you get a slightly different view. And it, by comparing images that were taken with light that you can see with your eyes, visible light, and this infrared light, they saw that the Cassini divisions, not only they confirmed that there was stuff in them, but the stuff was brighter than in infrared than the stuff in the other rings were. That's actually quite interesting, why this stuff that in visible light appears darker, in infrared light appears brighter. And also it appears to change with Saturn's season, with the orientation that it is to the sun.
Now, the interpretation of this is that the stuff in these gaps, the Cassini division, this C ring, this darker ring around, and the rings again given letters in order of discovery. So the C ring was the third discovered. It's darker, so hard to see in visible light, but what the infrared tells you is the temperature of the material.
That's right,
so the material is darker, it's blacker, it absorbs sunlight more easily, that's what black things do, and it warms up a bit more, and as you say, it's seasonal. Now, my first thought on reading this story was doesn't Cassini tell us this? But of course Cassini's very close to Saturn and doesn't always get the big picture, doesn't always see it at the right angles with respect to the sun that make it useful to do
this. That's right, because if you're looking at an effect that happens only when the sun is a certain angle to the rings, then the Earth is ideal for that, and something that's orbiting around Saturn or very close to Saturn isn't ideal for it. So that's why this study is actually quite interesting. And, you know, Saturn's always produced beautiful pictures.
Yeah. And in fact, this story, this result came out of someone trying to make a public release image from an infrared and a visible light image and went, oh, that's different. And it's prompted this research, which is always nice. Heading into the distant universe now and looking at galaxies rotating. So there's a result out in a very prestigious journal called Nature. It's a very prestigious scientific journal about how looking at how galaxies in the distant universe are spinning. Now, this has been done in our universe. It was done with very local galaxies back in the 1970s by an astronomer called Vera Rubin. Vera died last year, unfortunately, she did lots of research in the 1970s to establish that the speed that galaxies are rotating and the stars and the gas in galaxies are rotating with actually tells us about what the galaxies are made of. And this is this weird stuff called dark matter.
Yeah, if galaxies were solid compared to actually what they are, which is composed of lots of different stars, you'd expect them to rotate differently in the centre and at the edge. And she found that actually because galaxies aren't solid, she expected them to rotate one way. And then when she looked at the speed that stars were rotating from comparing the centre all the way out to the edge, she noticed that there must be something in the galaxy which we can't see. And like you said, it's called dark matter.
You can compare this to our solar system. So Mars orbits the Sun more slow than the Earth because it's further away from the Sun. Jupiter orbits more slow than Mars because it's further away. Saturn even slower still. Uranus slower still. Neptune slower still, for example. And that's because the vast majority of the mass of the solar system is right in the centre. And with galaxies, they kind of expected that to be the same. Most of the stuff is in the centre, and they found that there must be other stuff further out that we don't see, this dark matter, as you say. Now, in the distant universe, this study has been looking at galaxies much further away. I think it was 10 billion light years away or something, so very, very, very distant, and trying to study them. Now, galaxies that are that far away appear very small, so you have to have a very powerful telescope to see them. They're much fainter, so when you're trying to look at their rotation speeds and you need to split the light into its different wavelengths with a spectrometer and so on, that's even harder still. But they seem to have got a result that implies that the galaxies are behaving as if there was no or much less dark matter in them, which is maybe not as revolutionary as it sounds, but an interesting result for early galaxies.
Yeah, and you have to remember that with astronomy, we can't go to these things. You know, we have to always study the light from our telescopes and interpret that. And one of the big differences that you've got between the ones that Vera Rubin looked at and that we've since verified and this group of galaxies is that the distance. So you're looking at ones that not only are very far away, but also are at a different point in their lives. They're very, very young when we're looking at them. The light's taken much, much longer to get to us. So the implication could be that when galaxies first formed, we don't really understand how galaxies formed, but when galaxies first formed, this dark matter was in a lower concentration, or it has some impact on how dark matter gets into galaxies. Again, something that we don't understand. We can see in much better detail galaxies nearby, but we want to bridge that gap between the galaxies that we understand nearby and the galaxies in the that are very young in the way distant past.
And this is this result is not universally accepted. There are people who have looked at this result and gone, oh, not actually quite sure. You're not looking far enough out in the galaxy to actually be able to tell the result isn't actually conclusive because you need to actually get more data. And this is how science, although it sounds like maybe an argument and people arguing over things, this is how science works.
Yeah, we have to, as scientists, we have to, as soon as you see a result, you have to try and, for your own scientific rigor, try and disprove it. Because it's very difficult to prove something. It's much easier to disprove it. And that's what all scientists do. They try and disprove something, not to just be a pain, but to try and prove that to their own scientific rigor that this is a good result, that this is actually telling us something that we didn't expect, something new.
So the fact that there was a little bit of controversy is nothing unusual. It's quite nice. That, I mean, the controversy has been in blog posts and so on, which is always nice to see this in the public sphere. So it's transparent, if you like. It's not done behind closed email loops or anything.
And the good thing about the people blogging about it is that the people blogging aren't people, you know, that are inexperienced. These are professional scientists that are taking this result and doing their own analysis of it. And presenting a different side to the result that's in the paper. This is something that really you couldn't do before the blogging platforms and the internet was at the state it is today. And I think it's an amazing aspect of science that opens up science to actually a far larger audience, because the language that you use when you write a blog post is very different to the language you use in a paper. And I even find papers are actually very difficult to read. The language in them, there is a certain way of writing papers that actually makes it very complicated to a lay reader to understand what's going on. And that doesn't necessarily mean a non-scientist. That means somebody who doesn't work in that area of science. And so having blog posts which expand on something and have a different take, I think is good for science.
Yeah. And 10 years ago, 15 years ago, to disprove or to disagree with an interpretation of some data, which is, as you say, is the way science works, would have been, you'd have had to publish another paper to disprove it, and that takes a long time.
This or give a conference talk or something.
This is a much faster way of doing this, which is good.
And more opinions are better.
Yes. And of course, what I didn't do with the blog is scroll down to read all the comments, but on these kind of things, the comments aren't normally too bad. They're not like YouTube comments. They're normally a bit more sensible, so I'll do that when I get a second to go and read the blog post again. Okay, now we said earlier we'd talk about TRAPPIST-1, this star system about 40 light years away, now known to have 7 planets in it. The news of there being 7 planets was announced at the end of February, and it's been out for about a month now. People have had time to digest it, but I mean, briefly, the result was that there were 7 planets in the system, whereas previously there were only thought to be 3. And they're all very close to their star. And in fact, it's possible that maybe three of them could have liquid water on their surface. There's a lot of coulds and possiblies in there, but that's the broad brush story.
That's right. And the star is not like the sun at all. It's very cool compared to the sun. It's a dwarf star. And the whole solar system, as far as we know it at the moment, would fit inside the orbit of Mercury. So it's very much smaller scale, very different to our solar system. Yet we think that there could be water on the surface of at least three of the planets in liquid form. Now, like you said, it is could, maybe, because this whole question of habitability is... It's really something that is used to sell the science instead of the science, because as scientists, we're always trying to get our interesting stories out. And I really think that habitability is pushing the limits of what we can really expect in return from it. I mean, we're not going to find out whether there's aliens on this planet. We're not going to find out anytime soon whether there actually is liquid water on the surface of the planet. Or if it could sustain life. Actually, we don't know whether the presence of liquid water is what you need to sustain life. Certainly sustain life that we know about on Earth, but not necessarily to form life. So it is certainly a very, very interesting, scientifically interesting solar system. But whether it could have alien life on it, I think, is a totally different question.
Well, to find out what we do know about the system, I spoke to one of the researchers based at the University of Cambridge. The team who made this discovery. Well, joining me on the line now is Amaury Triot from the University of Cambridge, a member of the TRAPPIST team. So welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Now, this discovery that was announced back in February of this year, built on a previous discovery by the same team. Can you tell us a little bit about what the history of this TRAPPIST-1 discovery from a few years ago up till now?
Yeah, so we started observing ultra-cool dwarfs, stars that are much smaller than the Sun, to look for planets, because they're easier to find. It's easier to find small planets around small stars than around big stars. And we started monitoring TRAPPIST-1 as part of a wider survey of different stars. And in 2015, in the autumn of 2015, we noticed the first transit. So a planet passed in front of that star, casting a shadow, and we noticed it right away. So then we monitored that star intensively, and we saw different transits coming back, and we announced in May 2016 that three planets were orbiting this star. However, we weren't completely happy with the final solution. We knew that within the data there were a couple of signals that looked like additional planetary transits, and there was an issue with the original planet D, the third outermost that we had announced in 2016. So we carried on with more observations from ground-based telescopes and then moved on to space-based telescope, the Spitzer telescope that is run by NASA. And that's when we saw a series of seven planets passing in front of the star in what is now an unambiguous discovery.
So there's no doubting that these are there. There are definitely seven planets. They're all very firmly detected in the data.
Exactly. Yeah, we can separate each of the signals because each planet will cast a shadow that is slightly different in depth, in amplitude. That is because the planets have different sizes and they cast shadows that are deeper as a function of the size. And also the duration of each of the event is slightly different. It gets longer and longer for longer orbital period.
Okay. Now, so you've got these seven planets. The star we now call TRAPPIST-1, it has got a much longer name from its original discovery as part of the TUMAS survey from a few years ago. It's called TRAPPIST-1. Is it presumably not the only star you were looking at, or was there a big catalogue and this is one that you got lucky with?
So we started with a catalogue of about 50 objects, and this name we gave once we identified the planets around it. Essentially, the name is the name of the telescope plus the first planetary system that we found. Essentially, you have to see it as more as the TRAPPIST catalogue of transiting planet, of which this is just the first installment.
Now, this system has seven planets, which is pretty amazing for a system that's fairly rare in terms of our discoveries of extrasolar planets so far. We also know that these are probably all rocky planets, or close to being rocky planets. How do you determine? I mean, you see their size when they pass in front of the star. That tells you about how big the planet is. How do you determine whether they're rocky or not, or whether they might be rocky?
There are several ways, but the easiest and the most straightforward is to measure the mass. If you have mass and radius, then you can calculate density, and you compare that density to the density of rocks, for instance, and you see that they match. The way we have measured the mass of this planet is by accurately measuring when transits happen. So the planets, all of the seven planets in TRAPPIST-1 are close to one another. It means that the planets interact with one another. They orbit, essentially the year they take as they move around the star is never exactly quite the same. So if you take TRAPPIST-1S, for instance, it goes around the star every 9.1 days. But this will change plus or minus 1 or 2 hours. These changes are basically caused by the planets exchanging energy between each other, and so slightly altering the orbital path. So when we measure when the transit happens, which every now and then happens late and sometimes a bit early, the time that it is early or the time that it is late gives us indication on the mass of one planet relative to another. And so because we have seven planets, we can measure all of the relative masses between the planets, and that gives us an indication of how massive they are and therefore what composition they have.
So you learn a lot more from this than you do from an ordinary system of transiting planets, and that's just because it's so compact? That's essentially what gives you that, is that correct?
There are two things. One, that it is compact, so it is true that the interactions between the planets are quite strong. You have to imagine that more as a tide. So, for instance, the Moon is quite close to Earth, therefore we feel a tide from the Moon, but not from Mars or from Venus, for instance. Another aspect is that the planets are close to what we call resonances. So the planets are, in a sense, synchronized. When one goes, say, TRAPPIST-1b goes 8 times around its star, TRAPPIST-1c, the second innermost, goes exactly 5 times. These special orbits strengthen this interactions between the planet, making it easier for us to measure the mass.
And that's something we see in our solar system, right? We see those kind of resonances at all sorts of places in our solar system. That's not unusual, unique to this planet, this TRAPPIST-1 system.
Well, I mean, it's something that we wish we could see more frequently. We see it in the solar system mostly in the satellite system. So if you look at the satellites around Jupiter, for instance, you have what we call the 4-to-2-to-1 resonance between Io, Europa, and Callisto, three of the satellites of Jupiter. So TRAPPIST-1 actually looks quite closely to Jupiter in terms of the orbital periods and the sort of configuration that the planets occupy, more, for instance, than the planets of the solar system to the Sun.
So you have these seven planets at various distances from the Sun. One of the big things people obviously want to ask about is what are those planets are going to be like? We don't really know. We can't see them. We can't see the planets directly. But what assumptions do you end up having to make any assessment of whether these planets are possibly going to be habitable and so on?
At the moment, the only indication we have is the distance. So from the distance from the star, we have an idea, a rough idea of the temperature, or the amount of energy, rather, that the planet receives. Ultimately, for water to remain liquid, you need several ingredients. First, you need water to be present, and we don't know that yet. Second, you need the right conditions. So water is liquid on Earth because we have the right temperature, but also the right pressure in the atmosphere. So our next stage is to actually learn more about the atmospheres, trying to figure out how dense they are, what is the pressure at the surface, how good they are at retaining or preventing heat within the atmosphere. So say you take the innermost planet, it would be good to have a little bit of atmosphere to redistribute heat from the day to the night side of the planet, for instance, which could lead to liquid water being present on the night side of the innermost planet. For the outermost planet, you could think of a very thick atmosphere, a bit like that of Venus, for instance, with intense greenhouse effect, which would then trap any little amount of energy that the star sends to the planet into the atmosphere, and therefore rendering the conditions locally habitable. So unless we know about the atmosphere, we can't really know whether the planets are truly habitable or not. Habitable here means actually that water could remain liquid for a long time. So that is something that will come in the future. But what's great and what separates TRAPPIST-1 from many other planetary systems found before is that this is the first one on which we will be able to know whether the conditions are right or not. Because of planet transit and because of the properties of the stars, we will be able to access to the atmospheres. We will be able to measure chemical abundances, so what kind of gas are within the atmosphere and with what quantity. And so we will infer what are the conditions at the surface.
And is that something you can do with current technology, or is that something that's going to need future missions? Is that something you're currently able to do now?
It entirely depends on the type of atmosphere. So, for instance, we have started already studying the atmospheres of planet B and C. We have already published a scientific paper out of this in July last year. What we were trying to see is if those planets had a hydrogen-based atmosphere, a bit more like Uranus and Neptune. At the time, we weren't completely certain those were Earth-like planets, and so it seemed prudent to test whether they were more like mini-gas giants or whether they were more like Earth-like objects. So depending on the atmosphere, you can use current tools. If the atmosphere is very tenuous, you're going to require, I think, more precise instruments like the James Webb Space Telescope. In all fairness, if the planet has an atmosphere very similar to that of the Earth, in order to learn more about the conditions at the surface, then we will need the James Webb Space Telescope.
And that's something that James Webb will be able to do, you think, with this particular star? It's close enough and bright enough and big enough it will be able to do that? Excellent. Well, that's certainly something to look forward to.
It's quite an incredible time to be alive. You know, I think we have a real chance if those atmospheres are good to know it, and if the planets are inhabited, we have a very good shot at knowing it within about 10 years, thanks to the James Webb Space Telescope. It's a very lucky time.
Well, one thing I've wondered about this is that the observations with the Spitzer Space Telescope were done over a fairly short period. It was one campaign to stare at this star with Spitzer. Were you seeing that data as it came out live? I mean, did you see that as it was happening, or did you wait till the end to see what the result was?
No, the data was sent in chunks. If you've looked at the data, every now and then you see there's a little hole in the data. That's when the spacecraft turned in order to broadcast its data back to Earth. Then all the data got collected into an institute in California, and then they forwarded us the data every now and then in sort of large chunk. Mm.
And so over time, as you looked at each chunk as it came in, were you saying, oh, there's another planet there, we found another transit or something? Was the excitement building over the whole period?
Yeah, so we had an idea that there were a few more than the three original planets we had announced. But as soon as the first chunk of data came, it was immediately clear that the system was incredibly rich with planets inside. It was almost unbelievable, so beautiful it was. And so clear as well. The detection is extremely clear.
It is a wonderful data set, and the images just from the data itself are astounding, as well as obviously all the artist's impressions and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
Now this is a fascinating system with all these seven planets being so close to its star and so on. I guess it will be wonderful to be able to find something else that looked like that. Is there a? Do you think there's a recipe for trying to find this kind of thing again, or is it just luck going to find the right star?
So when you set out to find something and you find that thing, I would not call it luck. We wanted to find planets around stars like TRAPPIST-1. TRAPPIST was a prototype for a much more ambitious survey called Speculoos. Speculoos consists of four telescopes that will monitor stars similar to TRAPPIST-1 and search for planetary transits in exactly the same way. So TRAPPIST was a small telescope. It was set to test if we indeed had the capacity to detect, the precision essentially to detect Earth-sized planets on these stars. We showed that it was indeed possible. Then funding was accepted to build this larger, more ambitious facility called Speculoos. And then as we were passing contracts to construct these new telescopes, TRAPPIST continued to observe. That's when TRAPPIST-1 was identified. Now I'm happy to report, actually, that we just had the first telescope installed in Chile for Speculoos, the first of the four, with our first data obtained just last night. And from that, we already know that we will have the capacity to detect many more systems. Normally, with Speculoos, we will observe 10 times more stars than we did with TRAPPIST. And so our hope is to find, quite simply, 10 times more planetary systems. If each of them has 2, 3, 4 planets, then you can make the count. This is dozens of worlds we're going to detect, dozens of worlds that we will be able to study the atmosphere of.
Well, it sounds incredibly exciting. You said it earlier, actually. It's a wonderful time to be in this field, to be discovering these planets. So now, I know that there's lots more information online at TRAPPIST.1. That's TRAPPIST.one, if you want to go and find out more. But for now, Amaury Triol, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
Well, as we said earlier, the result is there's a lot of coulda, shoulda, wouldas in there about the... What we know or what we don't know about the system. There's a lot of stories that come out about exoplanets and planets around other stars. We've had stories about the Earth-sized planets and an Earth-sized planet that's in a habitable zone, so a rocky planet in a habitable zone. Are we at risk of boring people, do you think?
I think everybody is always interested in exoplanets. It's partly because of the tantalizing nature of the quest for alien life, but also I think it ties in with the exploration of space. It's a planet that could host alien life, but it could host us. Mm. And if we only had, you know, better technology to fly into space, perhaps humanity could visit these planets. And this star system is actually pretty close. It's only 40 light years away. Mm. In terms of the galaxy, you know, that's really our next door neighbours. So it sort of does lend itself to that sort of thing. And I think people will always be interested in hearing about this diversity of planets, because we've got a huge diversity of planets in our solar system.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was most interesting, I think, when the exoplanets started being discovered going around other stars, because those they were not like our stars, our solar system. There were planets the size of Jupiter or bigger orbiting much, much, much closer to their star than Mercury is, so very unlike our solar system. We found planets. We thought we were going to find solar systems that had rocky planets in the middle, gas giant planets on the outside, just like our solar system, because that made sense. We thought we knew how our solar system formed, and then that all went, you know, to hell in a dustcart kind of thing.
That's right, and also orbiting stars that were like the sun.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's the one of the big missions that found a lot of planets was Kepler, and it was particularly looking for planets that were orbiting stars that were like the sun. But the very first system of exoplanets that was discovered were orbiting a star that is nothing like the sun, a neutron star. The remains of a star that was very much more massive than the sun that exploded. And in that explosion, just all of the elements in the star were converted into neutrons, and that still had planets going around it. So really, there is it's quite amazing the number of planets that we found, and actually the number of places and different places that we found these planets.
Well, there's certainly lots of discoveries to come. I hope we don't bore anyone with stories about exoplanets. It is interesting to try and say why they're different. I think this story in particular was interesting because there were so many planets so close together around one star. And the fact that we could tell the mass of the planets and the size of the planet, or we could tell the size of the planets directly from the measurements, but we could infer the mass of the planets from other properties of the measurements, which actually we can't normally do. That's something that was unique with this, which gave us a better handle on how big they were. And of course, the artist's impressions are out there. If you look at the various stories on the European Southern Observatory website or the NASA website or elsewhere online. The artists that have done those have actually used scientific information to make the artist's impressions. The ones that might have water, they've given a hint of blue. The one, you know, they've actually taken. I mean, there's clearly a lot of artistic license in there because all we see is a star gets a bit fainter, and you know, we don't see the planets themselves at all.
That's right. Not in this case, we don't.
But you know, they do use, you know, all the information available to try and think about what they might look like. A little bit science fiction, but erring towards science facts,
yeah,
which is always fun.
So if you want to learn any more about most of these stories today, I write for an astronomy news website called Space Scoop. You can find it at spacescoop.org. And you'll find stories about TRAPPIST-1, about the strange rotation curves of galaxies, and even the strangely glowing Saturn's rings on there.
So do go check that out. Until next month from us, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.